The New York Times published an op-ed by Judith Serber and Justin Maxson, who collaborated on a multimedia story about the destructive impact of prescription drugs, heroin, and fentanyl on her family's life in the Hoopa Valley Indian Reservation. Judith wrote the story, which the New York Times titled, "Addiction Ravaged My Family and My Tribe. I'm Fighting to Get Them Back." Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange, Judy.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And Justin Maxson produced the photography and motion captures for the story in the Times. Welcome, Justin.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure. I just want to say that I grew up listening to Jefferson Public Radio, so it's an honor to be here with you today. Thank you.
Well, we're glad you're a listener as well. Judy, I'd like to start with you. How did the New York Times learn about your story?
You know, me and Justin had been collaborating for a while on this, and he had some contacts there, and correct me if I'm wrong, Justin, but he reached out and did the pitch about what we were working on, and there was interest, and then it grew from there.
So, Justin, tell me about that.
Yeah, of course. So, you know, Judy and I have been working on a number of projects over the many years. You know, we've known each other for over a decade. We're friends. We are now, in my opinion, I consider her family. And it was the beginning of 2023. Judy was telling me what was going on with her family and how there were many failures in care. And one of the main issues is that she couldn't find care for her 13-year-old granddaughter who was dealing with substance use disorder. And there were two facilities in California that both denied her access to care. And so we thought, you know, this is a systematic issue. And I mean, Judy, you can talk about that experience, but we felt like it was important to bring the story out into the public. And so I pitched it to a number of publications that I had relationships with. And Jackie Bates, who's the director of photography at the New York Times Opinion, took the story. And we worked on it for 11 months. I basically spent most of my time sleeping on Judy's couch. I was trying to photograph the family as if I was contributing to a family album. And at the end of 2023, they published the story.
Well, it's interesting because I was going to ask you how much access you had, but apparently you had full access.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. Like I said, Judy's like family to me, and I would do anything for her and her kids. And so, yeah, I was there for every step along the way. And it was a collaborative process. We talked about what images we wanted to include, what we didn't, what we wanted to say. And so it was definitely a relational process for the both of us.
Well, Judy, you're an amazing writer. I have to tell you that. And your story is compelling. So before we go into the story and the background behind it, I'd like to know a little bit more about you and how did you hone your skills as a writer?
So I've known ever since I was little that I was a writer. I've always kept journals. I've always written poetry, written short stories. I love fiction. I'm working on my third book now. I don't have like a big university background. I don't have degrees in writing or English, but I love to write. And as a job, I've been a grant writer for the tribe for years. I've been really successful at it. I'm good at selling that emotional part of it, that kind of grasp unders. And so just something I really enjoy. Right now I'm focusing doing a historical fiction based here in Hoopa, but I'd started a lot of books and my first book, Reservation High, I would start books and then get lost after a chapter or two. And I finally decided the problem was I wasn't writing what I knew. And the one thing I know is substance use and the effects and how people deal with it. And so that was what my book, it's fiction, but it's real. And it's about a girl who, you know, is going through recovery. It's about Native life here in Hoopa. And after the New York Times story came out, it got picked up by a publisher and went out for a reprint a few months ago. So the New York Times story really opened a lot of doors for me personally on the writing level. And the story for the New York Times came really easy to me. The hardest part was that they limited. There was a lot more I wanted to say and could have said, but there was word limits. So, you know, after the story came out, I have gotten literally hundreds of emails from people all over the world who want to know more, or how can I help, or you're my daughter, my son, I'm in the same boat, or how can I help, or what can we do? So it was an amazing experience. And for a writer to be in the New York Times was pretty amazing, you know.
I imagine. So you received all of this attention, and your book now is in reprint. What's the name of the book?
Reservation High.
Reservation High. And you told this story in a compacted way within the New York Times constraints, of course, but it's quite compelling. So take us back to the beginning. Tell us about your family and how this story came about.
So I always start off saying that I have lost everything pretty much to fentanyl, and I've never done drugs in my life except smoke some weed as a teenager. That's the extent of my own substance use. But the people I love most in the world have been really affected by substance use. It started with the OxyContin. I had a front row seat to that. My husband died in 2019. We were married for almost 40 years. We had had four children together. We would now have eight grandchildren. And he was just a really good man. He was a Yurok tribal member. He was a logger. He worked really hard taking care of me and his children. And in the late 1990s, he got in a logging accident. And I remember he hurt his back bad. And the first thing the doctor came in and said was, you know, there's a new drug on the horizon here. And it's short lasting or long lasting, but you don't get addicted. And it's called OxyContin. And we're going to start giving you that. And it's going to take your pain away. And that was the beginning of the end.
Let me interrupt you right there, because okay. I have a question just on that point. But let me remind the audience, my guests are Judith Suber and Justin Maxson. They collaborated on a multimedia story published by the New York Times titled Addiction Ravaged My Family and My Tribe. I'm fighting to get them back. So, Judy, you're telling me, as I understand it, that the very first introduction of this drug and this path that just sort of ravaged your family was introduced by a doctor.
Yes. It was definitely through a medical doctor who was treating my husband for his logging injury. And at the time, that was the push, you know, not just for my husband's, but thousands of people, where they did not understand how addictive OxyContin was. And so what started off as a 20 milligram a day quickly became 40 to 80 to misusing it, not taking it as it was supposed to. And then all of a sudden it was pulled from the market. And so many people I know at that point went on to heroin. I didn't know for years. I was so naive. I didn't know my husband had already graduated on at that point. He was so discreet. He was so functional. I think people don't understand that people can be on substances and be very functional. You could be working with them and not know it. And so, you know, his came by way of doctors. But at the time then, the recreational part of OxyContin here in Hoopa became very rampant. So many teens started experimenting with it. Like, it was something they would do on a Friday night. Somebody would have a OxyContin and they would, you know, chop it up and snort it. Or so I had two sons who started on that path. It wasn't through the doctor, but it was through recreation. They were young teenagers, and that started them on a pathway of substance that went from that to heroin and now to fentanyl. So,
quick question. Let me interrupt again. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
But why heroin? Of all the various different narcotics out there, why are people, if they can't get OxyContin, they are moving on to heroin? Why?
Well, that was back then, because now you'd be hard-pressed to find heroin now that fentanyl's on the horizon. But I believe because the, you know, they called OxyContin hillbilly heroin, the next thing up, you're not going to go from OxyContin to Norco. That wouldn't be strong enough for what people had gotten used to. So heroin was kind of the next progressive step that would hold them, because the withdrawals were so horrible from OxyContin. People would try to stop. They would try to cold turkey. They would try to get off of it or be cut off of it abruptly. And I don't know if you've seen people coming through. Oh, I have, coming through withdrawal with OxyContin, and it's pretty bad. So they would then go to the next thing, which pretty much became heroin, is what became readily available, a lot cheaper. At the time when OxyContin was pulled, you know, you could get $60 for an 80 milligram pill, one pill, $60, which is crazy in a environment where I live, where people don't have money, you know. So, and most people would need two or three of those a day. So with no job and no money, how do you come up with $180 a day, right?
It's a good point. Let me ask you, and I hate to interrupt this story, but one more time, the withdrawal symptoms, what are those like?
Well, at the time, I thought they were really bad. But now that I've seen people trying to get off fentanyl, it doesn't even look as bad. But it is just being in bed. They say it's like having the worst flu of your life. Your whole body hurts so bad. You're puking. You have diarrhea at the same time. Massive headaches, leg twitching, leg cramps. And they said it's just unbearable. I mean, I've heard people say, I would rather die than go through that withdrawal. I've seen people trying to come off fentanyl now, and it actually was much worse than that and lasted a lot, lot longer. So I think as the drugs get stronger, from OxyContin to heroin, heroin to fentanyl, they say that fentanyl's 50 times stronger than heroin. And I believe the withdrawal process is like 50 times harder too.
Oh, that is astonishing.
Right. And people don't want to stay. Nobody I know says, oh, this is such a great life. I just want to stay on these drugs. That's not, it's because trying to get off is so hard and hurts so bad that most people I know say, they'll probably die before they can get off of fentanyl. There's such a hopelessness that's attached to it.
Now, I want to get into the story about your sons, but we're coming up on a break. And just before we get to that break, Justin, you had an opportunity to capture all of this. How did it affect you?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely wasn't easy for me because I have my own experience in recovery. I have an opioid use disorder when I was a teenager. And I was fortunate enough at that time to meet a man, a mentor. His name was Rosendo Medina. And he actually used to work at the Arcata Endeavor as basically a caseworker for people in transition. And working on this project definitely brought it back for me. But I mean, Rosendo was such a strong figure in my life, and he helped me see strengths that I didn't recognize in myself at the time, which I think helped me reconsider the value that I had, that I held in my community. So I definitely feel like his memory lives on in the work that I'm doing around the issue, especially as it relates to Judy and her family, just bringing my own care and presence into our working relationship. I believe that, especially around the issue of substance abuse, which is so misunderstood and stigmatized, especially as it relates to mainstream media. You know, the media plays a significant role in shaping our attitudes towards addiction. Historically, substance use has been portrayed in its most extreme forms, right? Needle in the arm, overdose, death, arrest. You know, these are the images that have been etched into our collective memories. And what they do is they villainize the user by suggesting that they are solely to blame for their life choices.
Justin was telling us about how just capturing the images of what Judith's family was facing had an impact on him as well. Justin?
Yeah, I think, like I mentioned before the break, I think it's important to document the issue from a point of view that doesn't further cause harm. And like I mentioned before, the images that we normally see are rooted in harm. And so I wanted to photograph Judy and her family with care, and I wanted to photograph them showing the love and presence that Judy was carrying forward into her relationship, right? I think that what Judy brings is just is a form of is a radical act, right? It's a form of resistance by not giving up on her family. And I think in the context of substance abuse with an Indigenous point of view, I think tough love doesn't work. And Judy, you can talk about this more specifically.
So Judy, you were telling us about your husband and how he ultimately was introduced to this pathway, but your sons as well. Tell us more.
Right. So, well, my sons came through it, through a recreational teen thing here where they were all trying it. Some of them doing Norco and then somebody got Oxy, but it took hold quickly too. I think OxyContin for especially people who have that gene to have substance use disorder can really catch quickly. And it's been a steady spiral. I can say one of my sons has just graduated out of inpatient rehab in April. He is on a methadone program and seems to be doing okay. My youngest son is not doing okay. He has chosen to live in San Francisco in the Tenderloin, homeless. It's dangerous. It's horrible. I've gone down there doing outreach from my program, and it broke my heart to see him living like that. It hurts me every day. And I just keep holding out hope that, you know, he's going to want to change things up. But right now, he doesn't even feel like he can do it. He feels like it's just too far gone for him. So it's hard to see. There's so many people who have been affected. And the fentanyl just seems to be a lot harder. I've seen people get off the heroin much easier. And fentanyl is just a much harder drug for people to get off of once they start using it. So,
Judy, how old are your sons?
34 and 38.
And you have a daughter?
I have another son, an older son than them, and I have a daughter who's 32.
And how are they doing?
They're doing fine. They haven't had the same issues. They hate substance, you know, they hate what they've seen. My daughter will say, you know, I love my brothers so much, but I hate the drugs. And so we are able to separate that out. Some people don't. Some families see their addicted loved one as, you know, the same as the drug. But we have really recognized that this isn't them. This is the substance that's leading them right now. So,
and you have a granddaughter?
I have a granddaughter who also was very young and had gotten, started having a lot of issues with fentanyl and had overdosed multiple times. She went to treatment and she's 16 now and she's doing very well. But it's always scary, you know, to me, I never know because there's always stories of somebody who's been clean for 20 years and then goes back. And so hopefully she maintains, but she's done a lot and turned things around. So I believe that she's going to be okay.
Tell me how you find help.
Well, for adults, it's really easy. I'm the MAT manager, medication-assisted treatment for Kamau Medical Center in Hoopa. And we have a lot of resources and we work with a lot of programs. if somebody came in today and said, I want to go into detox and to rehab, we can have somebody in a program within 1 to 3 days. We go to Eureka, Redding, San Francisco, Chico. We have programs lined up, and there's been a lot of funding that has gone into getting people help. For teens and Native teens specifically, it's really hard. There's two beautiful facilities, and this is part of what Justin was talking about failure of care, who are Indian health facilities. But if the children who you want to go there, if they have like dual diagnosis, any kind of mental issues, if they've had legal issues, if they've had suicide attempts, there's been a kind of pattern of denying these kids entrance. And without those programs, what's available is usually out of state. There might be private funded programs somewhere that cost $20,000 a month or something, but that's out of our league of what we can do. So
tell me about your region, where you live, and tell me about how this has affected your tribe.
The Hoopa Valley tribe in 2021 declared a state of emergency due to opioid overdoses. We, CDC came in and did a study from 2021 till 11/2023, and we had 27 fatal overdoses during that time period, which is significant for our small community because we only have a little over 3,000 people in Hoopa. So, you know, we lost a lot. Every family here basically lost somebody. Some people lost two family members to overdose. The majority, I believe, like over 3/4 of them were fentanyl related. And so we have done a push to get Narcan all over the valley. We have a Narcan machine here. I think there's only like two in Humboldt County, maybe three, and one of them is here, so that it's accessible 24/7. And we've done a lot of education and just flooding the valley with Narcan. And that seems to have helped a lot.
You mentioned that there isn't much money for people to afford access to these narcotics. How are they gaining access to them? And how can they afford care?
So the care, you know, there's funding through programs like mine that actually pay for people to go get help. If somebody comes here and has partnership, we can get them in. I have grant money that I've written in where we can pay for people stay. So I think that part is the easier part for people to use drugs when they have no money. In my New York Times article, I talked about how I had to start locking everything up because everything started disappearing. So there'll be a lot of, you know, theft or stealing, panhandling. I know that we have about 9 people here who have relocated living homeless in San Francisco because they say it's easier. You can panhandle that much in a day, and it's way cheaper on the streets down there than up here. So people find ways, you know, they ask their family for money, like everybody to give them $5. I mean, I've seen it all. Everybody has their own hustle. And
my guests are Judith Serber and Justin Maxson. They collaborated on a multimedia story published by the New York Times titled Addiction Ravaged My Family and My Tribe. I'm Fighting to Get Them Back. Justin, you were given a lot of trust to cover Judy's family so intimately. What's your process of discernment?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, again, because Judy and I are so close and we have a long history of mutual care and respect for each other, I mean, we're friends. We talked all the time on the phone, and we carried that relationship into this work, right? So there was always a conversation happening, right? I also never chose to photograph any substance use. That's something that I carry forward with me in all of my work because of just how stigmatizing it is. So yeah, as I was going, Jude and I were in conversation, like what we should and shouldn't include, how I wanted to frame the story. And there were times that I didn't take a picture. You know, I hung out with one of her sons quite frequently, and he, you know, he was using in front of me. And yeah, and I never took a picture of that because I think that's not what the story is about. So I think the story, in my opinion, is about Judy and her care and her love and her commitment to her family. And I mean, she's the strongest person that I know. And just what she goes through on a daily basis to me is just is tremendous. And she's just a rock for three generations of her family. Like, she takes care of her mother. Her mother lives in her room with her. She's constantly taking care of her family. Her mother, she takes care of her grandchildren. She raised her grandchildren since they were babies, and they recently got forcibly removed from her care, which is another part of the story. And then she's taking care of her adult children. So to me, that's what the story is about.
Yeah, she does sound like the glue. Who's taking care of Judy?
That's a good question. I mean, I definitely tried to be there for her as much as possible. And I think, Judy, who's taking care of you?
I don't even want to get started. I'll probably start crying here. Aww. But, you know, my writing helps a lot, truthfully. That's my escape. And I believe in this third book, I'm really sinking the historical fiction here. But it's historical of what really happened here. And I see my ancestors and my family members who went through horrible, horrible tragedies and things that they had no control over, and they still survived. And so sometimes I look at that when I'm writing, what I'm working on, and I think, if they can get through that, I will be okay. I'm going to get through this. And so I have a lot of friends and family who support me a lot and hold me up, and then I use my writing as my outlet. So
it does sound therapeutic. Justin, you received a Guggenheim Fellowship. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So as I've mentioned before, Judy and I have collaborated on a number of projects. And for the Guggenheim, I proposed continuing the work that Judy and I had began in 2023, which started as a way to bring attention to the gaps in care that exist around treating fentanyl. And now currently it's shifting towards building consensus about what better care might look like. And the title of the project, working title, is Decolonizing Care. And at the heart of the work is to challenge the status quo power dynamics that exist between care providers and those receiving care. You know, in traditional Western medicine, it's usually the provider that's giving advice, right? And what we're trying to do is flip the narrative or relationship, that typical relationship, by centering the voices of those receiving care and asking them to inform how providers deliver it. So essentially what it is, it's an applied research initiative that develops training materials for medical professionals along the West Coast, focusing on informing and improving best practices for fentanyl treatment, and with the goal of bringing together a wide range of people impacted by the crisis, you know, doctors, nurses, judges, harm reduction workers, law enforcement, people in recovery, and active users and their families. And the idea is to create a space where community-driven solutions can be developed in a collaborative setting.
And so, if all goes as you plan, what's the outcome you hope for?
Yeah, I think at the core of this work is reimagining care, right? We're asking, how do we build care models that emerge from people who have been most impacted? And I think at the root of the problem is a basic lack of understanding about substance use recovery and harm reduction. You know, a public opinion, I think, tends to treat addiction as a moral failure, like I mentioned. And I think most treatment systems are built around outdated models that aren't working for fentanyl. You know, for example, there's a misconception among medical professionals, and Judy talks about this a lot. Like, most medical professionals are prescribing Suboxone for fentanyl withdrawal, which doesn't work effectively for many people who have really high tolerance. And I think Judy can speak to that more.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there because we've run out of time. But I am so moved by this collaboration between you two and the relationship you have. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.